This is Ellie Sturton, this year's Arts News Coordinator and co-producer of CFRC Live Sessions and Release Radar Reels on Instagram. CFRC is thrilled to amplify local artists and musicians on our airwaves and social media, and to provide opportunities for them to get the word out about upcoming local concerts and events. Local really does live here at CFRC. Help us keep the magic going by making a donation to the station today via CFRC.ca. And thank you for your support.
Good evening. It is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's News Collective, Christina Laurie, Jesse Bell, Henry Walker, and Ellie MacArthur. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines. After the motion was withdrawn at their last meeting, Council revisited Councillor Connie Glenn's proposal to establish child safety zones in Kingston. The original motion asked staff to recommend amendments to the city's parks bylaw and community standards bylaw to create child safety zones, also known as sensitive use zones, within 50 meters of playgrounds, schools, daycares, splash pads, and children's sports fields. These zones would prohibit temporary shelters, the possession or use of drug paraphernalia, and open-air drug use in those areas. That motion was pulled after fellow councillors raised concerns about the ability to enforce additional measures and legal risk, especially concerning whether such restrictions could conflict with existing court orders around sheltering in public spaces. Taking that feedback, Glenn brought the motion back, this time with a different direction for staff. The revised motion asked staff to return with a legal opinion outlining the risks and limitations of passing bylaws that prohibit high-risk activities, such as erecting shelter, using or displaying drug paraphernalia, or consuming illegal substances within defined child safety zones, possible measures to reduce those risks, including alternatives for addressing encampments in public spaces, and how much of these prohibitions are already covered or restricted by existing federal, provincial, or municipal law. With this, staff would also provide options for council, either bylaw amendments or other approaches that could improve protection from high-risk activities within child safety zones. Delegation spoke before council, offering perspectives both for and against the new direction. Kingston residents Kevin Smith and Melissa Reed said the following before council.
I have lived experience with homelessness and have seen this issue firsthand. I've walked through parks and public spaces and seen things no child or even adult should have to see. This motion represents balance, keeping our parks and playgrounds safe for children while also showing understanding towards those who are struggling. Kingston has the opportunity to set an example for other cities by doing both.
Where's the infrastructure? Where's the consultation? Where's the trauma-informed service hub that should have preceded this motion? We wouldn't want people in the city to think that we lacked creative imagination. And yet here we are, debating a motion with no solutions, no new solutions, no new infrastructure, and no new vision for the people that live here.
Glenn made her case, emphasizing balance and the need to prevent children's exposure to high-risk activities.
I'm hoping that what my colleagues will see is that I took to heart their concerns. So this motion right now is about coming back with opinions and options and about continuing this conversation. Because the rights of one group shouldn't outweigh the rights of another. We have an opportunity to start to stem the tide. We know that exposure at an early age to these things is something that triggers it. Public health is invested, and our entire community, for that matter, is invested in, you know, basically controlling adverse childhood exposures and impacts. And so through those programs, we're working on that. So I'd like to ask my colleagues to join me in helping to explore the options for continued conversation about how we can balance the rights of both children and the others in our community to make this a broader conversation about opioid and drug use, which isn't just in the homeless population, but amongst the entire population of Kingston, unfortunately. and how we can work together to ensure safety in playgrounds, which should be joyful, fun places for our children to grow, learn, and explore.
However, some counselors were still hesitant. Counselor Ryan Bohm voiced multiple concerns, particularly around rights, enforceability, and the risk of pitting vulnerable groups against one another.
We can have all these rules, but it's the enforcement aspect that we're always going to struggle with. So whether it's 15 meters, 50 meters, or 500 meters, the whole thing here is we're really ultimately, and this is where I really struggle with it, is we're pitting two vulnerable populations against each other. I have five kids. I definitely want them to be safe in parks. I want them to be able to play and not step on, you know, broken glass and stuff like that. But I also have to be cognizant that the people that are part of the other vulnerable population that we're talking about don't have the supports needed to break away from that life. So there's a whole systematic breakdown here. And I'm just not sure that we're approaching this the right way. I just don't know how you're going to apply this short of somebody doing open drug use in a park, which I'm pretty sure is already illegal. I just don't actually think this is actually really going to do anything at the end of the day. I think this is just, it's like a little bit of grandstanding where we say we're doing something, but are we actually really doing anything effective?
Others like counselors Brandon Tozzo and Gregory Ridge argued that simply gathering information posed no harm and that council needed clarity before making any decisions.
We're not going to solve a mental health and addiction issue around this horseshoe. The crisis of the mental health and addictions, like I think we had staff do a budget of how much it would cost to solve it. I think it's somewhere in the ballpark of $500 million. We're going to move the dial a bit in one direction or a bit in another. And that's, I think, where what we can do. We can try to make our communities a bit better and a bit safer. More information is always better. If there's a legal opinion on anything further we can do, I have no problem going back to our legal team and getting that information and then making decisions based on that.
I think everybody wants children to be safe, and we're struggling with a number of pieces around enforcement. And I get a lot of feedback from parents in my community about that, certainly. I am happy to support this motion simply because of the question that was raised by Councillor Bohm about enforcement, right? So if we can get more clear legal opinions on what enforcement methods are available when they are necessary.
Mayor Brian Patterson introduced an amendment to the motion, expanding the scope to include other public spaces beyond those listed by Councillor Glenn.
So when we're asking for a legal opinion on the risks and limitations about, you know, creating these child safety zones, including within a specified distance of public playgrounds, schools, splash pads, and children's sports fields, I've just would propose that we also add the wording "and other public places." The reason for that is that the children don't just go to public playgrounds and they don't just go to schools and splash pads and sports fields. Children also walk down the sidewalk. Children also go downtown. Children also go to other public places along with adults. In fact, some of the biggest concerns that I have faced are not just what some families and kids have encountered in public parks, but also even just walking down the street. I had one father and daughter who came right into City Hall and talked about what they had seen happen just right out in the square behind this building. So I think that I think we should look at it. Again, other cities have done this, so I don't think it's unreasonable to look at this approach. But I do think expanding just to add other public places, again, would just broaden the discussion just to say, should we be looking at any other places, public places as well?
This amendment was well supported by those already in favor of the motion. And counselors who had hesitated said this broadened the discussion and prevented the issue from targeting specific groups.
To me, this is just a consideration about getting as much information as possible and seeing what more can be done. This doesn't necessarily, to me, show that we're planning on moving forward with any plan of action. But what Councillor Bohm did say earlier about the enforcement piece, I think this gives it a broader scope and it allows councillors to have additional information.
I actually can support this amendment, and I think it actually increases the scope of this to just create a safe city for all and doesn't pit people against each other. If it's safe for children to be kind of everywhere, well, then by virtue of that, it's safe for all of us to be there. So with this amendment, I could support the original motion. So I do hope that it passes. I think it actually broadens the discussion and really doesn't pit one vulnerable group against another the way the previous, without this amendment, the motion can kind of be sort of contrived.
Glenn accepted the amendment while clarifying that her goal was still to focus specifically on providing additional protections for youth.
So I'll let it go through if people are going to support it, because we are not at the point of making a decision about what we're doing. I do want to increase safety throughout the community, but so many of the other things that we need to do to improve safety are around mental health, addiction supports, housing, all of those things. But right now, I think our children deserve a little extra protection, which is why there was specific wording.
With the amendment, the motion carried with a vote of 12-1, with Councillor Shaves being the sole vote opposed.
So I'm hoping that we will see some options and opportunities to improve the situation for children and youth, and to make sure that they move ahead unburdened by addiction issues, that they get the supports they need. And I know that we will all continue to advocate for the mental health and addiction supports that the rest of the vulnerable community needs. And hopefully we will see both national and provincial responses. I think they're dearly needed. We're all struggling with this issue. But I'm grateful that what we're going to be doing is responding to the concerns of our community in a thoughtful and legitimate way. Letting them know that we are trying to find a way forward. It is not easy, and this is not about trying to polarize the community. It is about saying, what else can we do with the powers that we do have available to us?
Staff will analyze these spaces both in their totality and individually and return to council with a legal opinion and options for moving forward. After an uncharacteristically quiet few weeks in the University District Safety Initiative has now been lifted, marking an end to what is typically the fall party season. Homecoming, FOCO, and Halloween weekend all passed without much fanfare, prompting mixed reactions. For Bylaw and Kingston Police, the weekends were considered a success. Dan Hazel, supervisor of enforcement with the city, had this to say.
I'm really happy to report back to the community and the Queens community that this year's homecoming, the official weekend, was a very successful event. Very quiet on the enforcement end. There was really no hotspots of concern throughout the entire weekend. It was exceptionally quiet. It was nice to see the alumni back to our community. The oldest coat I saw was a 1972 alumni. Had a quick discussion on him, and it was really nice to see them come back to the community. For the second weekend, we did issue 13 penalty notices under the Administrative Monetary Penalties Bylaw, which is a very low number comparison to the last previous years. So I would say that the second weekend was also successful. I think from my side of the table, I just want to give a huge thank you to all of our community partners, the Queens community, Queens University, Kingston Police, the police liaison teams, and to the enforcement officers that were all on duty for the event to make it as safe as possible.
Hazel attributed the success to the work done leading up to the weekend, particularly improved communication and outreach with students.
I think the main factor right now is the communication ahead of the events. Exceptional coordination amongst the Queen's University community, the AMS, the Kingston Police, and bylaw enforcement, really just to identify the areas or times that we might need it, using social media posts and getting the information out to the public on what the University Safety District Initiative is. All those efforts seem to be trending as a community in the right direction, and it seems that the events are now becoming less and less enforcement-based and more community-oriented, which we're very happy to see. So I suspect for the future, into the next years, we'd continue with those models with the ultimate goal of having these events go off and no community safety concerns.
However, the biggest conversation among students and alumni wasn't about enforcement. It was about timing. Students and alumni continue to express frustration that homecoming has been scheduled during reading week in recent years, saying the shift has made it difficult for current students and returning grads to connect. Queen's undergraduate student Hannah Harrison voiced that feeling in a video posted on TikTok.
I think Queen's is absolutely diabolical for always making our HOCO on a day when it's our reading week and none of the students are here, and here's why. So yesterday I was visiting a family member who it was their 20th reunion from graduating from Queen's. We were at the Queen's pub and I went to the bar to get a drink, and there was a guy there who's got to be at least 85 years old. Okay, he graduated in like 1960. Okay, so do the math. And he's looking around, he looks kind of sad. And I was like, oh, hi, sir. Like, are you all right? Are you looking for someone? And he goes, well, I'm looking for the students. Where are the students? And I said, well, it's our reading week. Like, nobody's really here. And he goes, that makes me so sad, because what I look forward to the most about coming back to Queens is seeing all of you being so happy and having fun with your friends and reminding me of the best time of my life. So after my heart broke a little, I thought about it. And honestly, the whole point of Queens making homecoming on our reading week is so that we don't drink and party too much. Well, we just do it the next weekend anyway, so it literally changes nothing for us. However, it ruins the experience for the alumni who want to come back here and party like they're 20 again.
That sentiment has been echoed across social media by students and alumni alike, with many alumni saying they plan to include it in their feedback to the university. When asked about the scheduling choice, Queens responded in a written statement, quote, "The event took place on the third weekend of October, consistent with past years. Students continue to play an important role through volunteerism within their faculties and by supporting events, helping to create a welcoming experience for returning graduates," end quote. The university also noted that this year marks one of the highest attended homecoming weekends in recent years, reflecting a steady increase in alumni engagement over the past 3 years. Looking ahead, the 2026 dates are set for October 16th to 18th, once again landing at the tail end of reading week. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
This is Jesse Bell with your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. We begin with Monday, November 10th, daytime high of zero, so at the freezing point, with a 67% chance of snow. That's right, snow here in early November. 1 to possibly 3 centimeters worth of accumulation overnight. Tuesday, November 11th, Remembrance Day, daytime high of 2 degrees, breezy and cool with a mix of sun and cloud dropping down to zero overnight. Wednesday, November 12th, daytime high of 5, 80% chance of precipitation. We've got rain throughout the morning, clearing up and becoming cloudy in the afternoon. Thursday, November 13th, daytime high of 7 degrees with a little wet snow in the forecast, but we're talking less than a millimeter or so. It's going to feel closer to 2 degrees, very chilly, very breezy day here in the city of Kingston. Friday, November 14th, we're going to have the holdover from that Thursday squall, some trace amounts of freezing rain, once again, less than 1 millimeter in terms of accumulation, and that'll be in the morning before warming up a little bit and clearing into the afternoon. Saturday, November 15th, daytime high of 3 degrees, mix of sun and cloud. Sunday, November 16th, daytime high of 5 degrees with a 70% chance of precipitation in the forecast, dropping down to 1 overnight. And then starting off next week, Monday, November 17th, daytime high of 5, a mostly cloudy day here in the city of Kingston. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. Reminder that the LaSalle Causeway will be closed on November 16th from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m., so that's closed for all vehicles, cyclists, and pedestrians to allow for temporary opening of the main marine navigation channel. Please be advised of the following road closures for the Remembrance Day ceremonies: Bagot Street, Barrie 2 West, 10 to 11 a.m., Barrie Street, King to Stewart, 10:20 a.m. to 12 p.m., King Street, Barrie 2 West, 10:20 a.m. to 12 p.m., King Street, Lower University to Barrie, 8:15 a.m. to 12 p.m., and Ontario Street, Barrie to West, 11 a.m. to 12:45 p.m. Here are some relevant road closures for the week. Aberdeen Street, William 2 Johnson is closed for construction activity and staging. Albert Street, Princess 2 Mac is closed for construction activity and staging at 484 Albert. Berry Street, Queen to Colborne, closed for construction activity at 283 Queen. Earl Street, Collingwood 2 Toronto, closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. King Street, tragically hip way to Place d'Armes, closed November 12th at 8 p.m. to November 14th at 8 a.m. for event-related parking and storage at Slush Puppy Place. Kings Court Avenue, concession to First, closed until November 21st for gas main installation by Utilities Kingston. Raglan Road, Division Domain, closed until November 30th from 7:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. each day for a gas main installation. Toronto Street, Durham to Park, closed until November 28th for installation of new water, sanitary, and storm services. And Victoria Street, Union 2 Johnson, is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work.
This is Christina coming back in with your concerts and events calendars for this week. Tonight on Monday, November 10th, Mustache Trivia is on at the Toucan at 7 p.m. and Something in the Water hosts Trivia at 8 p.m. There's also comedy tonight as Henry Sir and Friends hit the Broom Factory at 7:30 p.m. For live music, Inner Harbor Jazz plays the RCHA at 4:30 p.m. and Jonathan Jones performs at the Coven at 5 p.m. On Tuesday, November 11th, the Kingston Public Market runs at Springer Market Square from 8:30 to 5. For music, Tom's Tunes Day Happy Hour Jam starts at 4 at the RCHA. Tim Lowton plays the Coven at 5, and there's open mic at Jersey's at 7 p.m. On Wednesday, November 12th, Board Games Night happens at Something in the Water at 8 p.m. It's a big karaoke night, Jersey's at 7 p.m., Timeout Bar at 8 p.m., and The Mansion at 9 p.m. At the Kingston Grand, the Debaters Comedy Show takes the stage at 7:30 p.m., alongside I Take Your Hand in Mine, also at 7:30. Concert picks include Billy Raful, Anna Graves, and Lake Porter at the Broom Factory at 7:30 p.m., and Ayun Huang and Mark Feuer at the Isabel, also at 7:30. On Thursday, November 13th, CFRC is hosting Fun and Games Night at Minotaur at 7 p.m., so be sure to come say hi. It's a busy night for trivia, Riverhead at 7 p.m., Grad Club at 8 p.m., and Queen's Pub at 9 p.m. Drag Bingo at Daft Brewing starts at 7 p.m., and I Take Your Hand in Mine continues at the Kingston Grand at 7:30 p.m. as well. For concert highlights, Abigail LaPelle plays at the Broom Factory at 7:30 p.m., Boys Night Out at the Mansion at 7:30, and Johnson Street with Wygo at the Toucan at 9:30 p.m. On Friday, November 14th, I Take Your Hand in Mine plays again at 7:30 p.m. at the Kingston Grand. Karaoke takes over the buckle at 9 p.m. On the concert side, Steve Strongman and the Kim Pollard Band hit Kingston Grand at 7:30 p.m. Hawksley Workman plays the Broom Factory at 7 p.m. and Samantha Martin and Delta Sugar perform at the Cove at 7 p.m. On Saturday, November 15th, the Kingston Public Market runs from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Holiday events kick off, including the Holiday Bazaar at Kingston Secondary School from 10 to 3 and the South Alley Holiday Market in Gananoque from 3 to 8. Plus, one-day choir at Artillery Park at 5:30 p.m. and two showings of I Take Your Hand in Mine at 2 and 5:30. Big shows on Saturday night include Rhea May at the Broom Factory at 7:30 p.m. and Rock for Ryandale at the Spire at 7:30 p.m. On Sunday, November 16th, to finish off the week, the Memorial Center Farmers Market runs from 9 to 1. At the Kingston Grand, Igniting the Imagination begins at 10:30, followed by Billy Goat's Gruff and Other Tales at 3:30. For concert highlights, Rhea May returns to the Broom Factory at 2:30. Lady and the Lads perform at Time Out at 4, and Eric and Megan play the Coven at 5 p.m. As always, you can find even more concerts and events on our website's events and concerts calendar at cfrc.ca. Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
Wow. What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear.
CFRC's annual funding drive campaign is now underway through December 31st. Help us raise $25,000 to support our local arts and artists and keep our community informed with local news, concerts, and event listings on air and on our website. Visit CFRC.ca today and make your gift to Kingston's longest-running broadcaster serving our community since 1922. Get a tax receipt via Queen's University or get sweet CFRC swag and enter to win our raffle draws featuring gifts from amazing local donors. For every $5 donated, you get one more chance to win. Thank you for your support.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office and supported by your friends at Modern City Taxi, we're pleased to present 47Teeth's new track, Portland Flower. The song and music video are about struggling with the unknown, like wanting to take a leap of faith but not knowing if you're making the right decision, or hoping that you're letting go of the right things and won't get burned in the process. Ultimately, the song is an emotional call for guidance from the universe. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Portland Flower by 47 Teeth on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. This is edition 289. I'm Stefan Christoph, and thank you so much for tuning in. On the broadcast this week, I'm going to be speaking with Zoe Alexandra, who works with the People's Dispatch in New York City. Zoe has chronicled and detailed local and global movements for justice in New York City and beyond over recent years. She covers social movements and leftist politics in Latin America, the Caribbean, and also in the United States. PeoplesDispatch.org is the website, and I think Zoe is a very meaningful voice to speak to right now, as she has been on the ground in different social movements, protests, demonstrations in New York City in support of Palestinian liberation and freedom. People taking the streets to oppose the genocide in Gaza. And it's always important to highlight and lift up alternative media projects today. So here's my conversation with Zoe Alexandra of the People's Dispatch for Free City Radio.
So there's a lot of shift in terms of reporting on the fact that there is a pretty significant protest movement in support of Palestine, in support of human rights in Palestine, against genocide, that's happening. Often a lot of that reporting kind of will play these like short clips, even though there are kind of growing number of like extended discussions, which are usually kind of theoretical or like policy focused. Zoe, you're kind of involved on the sort of nuts and bolts level of quite a lot of organizing, both in New York City where you live, but also in other spaces, like more coordinated spaces in the United States. Maybe you could like introduce yourself and share any thoughts about that, on sort of the importance of like, how do we talk about how these things work? Because I think we're in this kind of interesting moment where there's like thousands and thousands of people, particularly in their early 20s, who want to plug into this organizing. And definitely they're not going to get information about how to do that through mainstream reporting, if you see where I'm going.
Yeah. No, I think that right now, and especially we're almost at 2 years since the beginning of the genocide, I think there's been a radical shift, especially in North America, in terms of anti-imperialist organizing, anti-war organizing, and of course pro-Palestine organizing. A lot of people say that like there's no going back to where we were before the genocide started, and I think that's really true, and especially in terms of the movement in the United States, in Canada, even across other parts of the world. You know, there's a lot of, I think what's cool and what's really interesting about this moment is that it's not been just limited to the SJPs or SPHR in Canada, to these campus groups, but really has expanded to all sectors of society. And so whatever profession you're in, there's kind of a space for you to get plugged in and a space for you to start organizing. And I think a lot of that has happened somewhat organically, but also intentionally. And, you know, people who have been trying to raise hell about Israel's, you know, genocidal policies for the past several decades, more than that, you know, saw this as like a really important opening. I think, for example, the creation of like tech workers against apartheid, you know, actually intervening in the spaces where the technologies are created to actually carry out these really horrific genocidal policies and military strategies. So actually organizing the people who are perhaps writing the code for that. Health workers, you know, health workers have been, I think, a really strong backbone of this. There's been really powerful organizing happening. You know, people who perhaps were in a profession that felt very conservative, or in some spaces, you know, dominated by Zionists, for example, in New York, there's a really strong element of that. And in this moment, it's really like, when, if you're a health worker and you're not horrified about the fact that nurses, doctors, surgeons are being systematically targeted, then, you know, really, where is your humanity and where is your love for the people that you of course, swore to protect when you became a doctor. So I think all of these different professions, artists, students, professors, you know, are seeing how all of these sectors and areas of life are being impacted by the genocide being systematically targeted, all areas of society. So it's really provided a space for people from these sectors to organize, not just because of their politics, but where they're working, reaching out to their coworkers. And I think that's been a transformative experience for people. And you know, if you're in a big city, I think probably every week you see a protest or a mobilization happening, a direct action happening outside of like a corporation. There's so many different organizations and groups, whether it's, again, by your profession or, you know, your political leanings, the Socialist Party, progressive organization, really all the same way that all sectors of society are impacted by this genocide, all sectors of society are responding and are standing up to say that they do not support this, they don't want their tax dollars going towards it, and then above all, that the genocide against the people in Palestine has to end. So I think it's a really transformative moment for individuals, for humanity, and for the movement, for sure. And definitely people are not going to be the same after this.
So, Zoe, you had mentioned SJP and SPHR, so Students for Justice in Palestine and Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights in Canada. You had mentioned sort of this process of workers and folks in different spaces trying to connect on the issue and find a pathway to organize. I'm just trying to like spell out and think about how those conversations happen. There's of course the online space, but I think you would know very well kind of how the dynamics of a demonstration take place, just in the sense that if you sort of, I've done this once, if you sort of like come home after a protest and like try to like draw a diagram of all the different conversations that you've had at the protest and sort of all the interconnected issues that come up, whether it's local issues around housing or international, you know, history around, you know, U.S. imperialism in Japan. I mean, these spaces are like really important for how people like share ideas and come together. And that sort of fabric, like the social and like learning fabric of a protest, I feel like is often not really articulated so much. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think in many ways, those moments of collective action, of collective outcry, and of collective kind of, this outcry against what's happening, being able to articulate exactly what's happening, why it's bad, who's complicit, is a big learning moment for everyone. And again, it's almost been 2 years, it's been over 22 months, and, you know, being able to go out in the streets in a consistent way, also, you know, in addition to strengthening people's, you know, commitment to fighting for Palestine and fighting against this genocide, also understanding, like, actually coming out into the streets is an essential part of life, is an essential part of demanding that rights be respected, bringing your demands to the street, which is, you know, a history and a collective memory that, you know, the ruling class in the United States and in Canada as well would like to erase, that this part of our collective history. And I agree that they're really important moments of convergence. And, you know, like, there's the big protests where all of the different organizations come out, whether it's the, you know, Filipino diaspora groups or the student groups or, you know, any other Irish groups, Puerto Rican groups, everyone coming out onto the street with a united message. But also there's been really, really interesting, you know, different actions that have been taken, for example, on the example of health workers, actually identifying the spaces where their institutions are complicit. So, for example, a number of doctors brought a resolution to the American Medical Association and really tried to raise the awareness within that space of doctors, of people who, again, are in this service of protecting humanity, of curing and saving humanity, and actually bringing that message that, you know, what's happening in Gaza and the actions of Israel against health workers, against the population, is, of course, in direct betrayal of all of these values. And bringing people who maybe were just living their lives and not involved in any sort of activism, bringing them in, this is really crucial because it's not actually possible to put the pressure on the governments that are complicit, especially the U.S. government, unless many, many more sectors of society are involved in this struggle. It's not enough for just left groups to take it up or the diaspora community. It really has to be all sectors of society putting pressure on the government to change the policy and, you know, in our case, like, stop sending military aid to Israel.
Are there, like, some moments that you that stand out for you in New York City over the last few years? Like, kind of, what's the first moments that come to your mind in the context of everything that you just described?
Yeah, I mean, I remember probably in October 2023, a couple weeks after Israel began its intensification of its genocidal attacks on Gaza, and I was in actually New Jersey, in Paterson, New Jersey, which is a historically Palestinian community. And, you know, at that time, most of the people who were in the streets were really from that community, you know, had family in the West Bank or had family in Gaza. Still, there were thousands out in the streets, but it was much more restricted kind of to that community. And then probably like a week or two later, going to November 4th, the National March in Washington, D.C., where there was like 500,000 people from all different communities, all different walks of life coming together with a really, really strong message for the genocide to end. And of course, that was just 1 month into it. But I think that all of those people that have been activated are continuing to raise their voices. You know, even on a personal note, like, you know, I had a sibling that didn't really have developed kind of politics with regards to foreign policy. And after 2 weeks of the genocide starting, he told me, he said, you know, I never really understood before what you were talking about, and now I really get it. And now he's like constantly speaking out to his friends, to his coworkers about the genocide, trying to, you know, win people over, get them to take some sort of action. So I think, yeah, those moments really stand out because, you know, we all have to be on the streets or doing any action in any way we can. And seeing the transformation of people and so many people joining a cause that for a long time, you know, was really isolated. So, yeah, I think those moments are when I say, okay, like, we have to continue. We really do, because more and more people are understanding and are, you know, outraged, rightly so, that this is happening. So, yeah, those moments really bring that hope.
There is, you know, a lot of things to talk about in terms of this, like, gap between the powerful and the streets. Some people have said, and I found it interesting, that the gap has shrunk in the sense that politicians have been forced to kind of respond, particularly in the period you were talking about with Joe Biden being president, responding pretty directly to a bunch of elements of the Palestine Solidarity Movement, but not changing policies, right? And so come back to this point of how do you sort of sustain a movement when it's pretty clear that power is doing everything it can to completely step aside from addressing any of the demands. You've been involved in trying to create kind of movement power building spaces. You know, the People's Conference for Palestine was a very interesting space. Those aren't protests. That's another element of the process that you're speaking of. Why has that been important for you to be involved in?
Yeah, I think that it's really easy to get demoralized, unfortunately, because we are up against such a massive and well-funded machine. But I think that, yeah, it's difficult because you say, again, like, after 22 months, all of these protests, all of these actions, and we're seeing, like, the most tragic phase of this genocide, people starving, aid blockade, flotillas being, you know, rounded up and arrested. So, but I think that I think there is, you know, measurable change because, for example, Joe Biden was really happy to not have to ever talk about Palestine, but he was actually forced to because of the movement. He was forced to because he constantly got interrupted, because there were protests constantly outside his door demanding that he actually take action on this. And if we just look back like 10 years ago, that was definitely not happening, not only in terms of building the power of the movement, but in terms of it being an issue that politicians have to speak about, have to have a position on, and understanding that actually any position that they have will have a fallout. So I think this is really crucial to underscore because it is a horribly tragic moment. And so, again, it is easy to get that kind of defeat mindset. But, you know, there's going to be no victories. There's a saying in Panama that without struggle, there's no victory. And so, you know, consistently engaging this struggle in all ways is important because that is the only way that there will be a victory where the U.S. stops funding a genocidal state, a victory where the Palestinian people, of course, can have full rights and sovereignty and self-determination. So we have to, you know, engaging in all ways, building different spaces, you know, where people of different professions and life circumstances can engage and feel like they're able to make a difference is really important, because in order to make any substantial structural change in society, it has to be the majorities that are behind it. So any way that people are organizing and creating these spaces for discussion, for dialogue, and for action is necessary not only in this struggle, but for the future ones.
Maybe we can end on this point about New York, because it's been an important space for action. And I've noticed, you know, having been present there a few times and also in actions and also just sort of following what's going on, you do see like a lot of groups that are engaged in local issues being present, housing particularly. I'm thinking about during the Chinese New Year parade, there was also this collective of Asian activists who were present at the Chinese New Year parade to have a presence about Palestine. And then also there was like housing justice kind of local organizations, and that sort of connection between the local and the global, I think, has been really interesting and important also to talk about and name. Any thoughts about that and how that's playing out in New York?
Yeah, I think that it's really easy to get demoralized, unfortunately, because we are up against such a massive and well-funded machine. But I think that, yeah, it's difficult because you say, again, like after 22 months, all of these protests, all of these actions, and we're seeing like the most tragic phase of this genocide, people starving, a blockade, flotillas being, you know, rounded up and arrested. But I think that there is, you know, measurable change because, for example, Joe Biden was really happy to not have to ever talk about Palestine, but he was actually forced to because of the movement. He was forced to because he constantly got interrupted, because there were protests constantly outside his door demanding that he actually take action on this. And if we just look back like 10 years ago, that was definitely not happening, not only in terms of building the power of the movement, but in terms of it being an issue that politicians have to speak about, have to have a position on, and understanding that actually any position that they have will have a fallout. So I think this is really crucial to underscore because it is a horribly tragic moment. And so, again, it is easy to get that kind of defeat mindset. But, you know, there's going to be no victories. There's a saying in Panama that without struggle, there's no victory. And so, you know, consistently engaging this struggle in all ways is important because that is the only way that there will be a victory where the U.S. stops funding a genocidal state, a victory where the Palestinian people, of course, can have full rights and sovereignty and self-determination. So we have to, you know, engaging in all ways, building different spaces, you know, where people of different professions and life circumstances can engage and feel like they're able to make a difference is really important, because in order to make any substantial structural change in society, it has to be the majorities that are behind it. So any way that people are organizing and creating these spaces for discussion, for dialogue, and for action is necessary not only in this struggle, but for the future ones.
That was a conversation with Zoe Alexandra, who works with the People's Dispatch. You can find them online at peoplesdispatch.org. Zoe is based in New York City, and thank you so much for being on the program today. This has been another edition of Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoff. I host and produce the show. Thanks for tuning in. We broadcast weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m. On CJLO 1690 a.m. also in Montreal on Wednesdays at 8 a.m. On CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m. On CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m. On CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m. On Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m. On CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. On CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Thursdays at 4:30 p.m. And on CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. We are also podcasts. Just look us up by searching Free City Radio on your favorite podcast platform. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I will speak to you next week.
short set of stairs, join me, Grim, in the basement for my working knowledge.